Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining me today is Angelo Calboni, president and CEO of Saratoga Hospital and its affiliates since 2006. His tenure has been marked by strong growth and increased emphasis on collaboration and innovation, cost-effective approaches to meeting the Saratoga region's challenging healthcare needs. Under Calboni's leadership, Saratoga Hospital has added services, facilities, and staff, and increased annual revenues, net worth, and financial assistance for those in need. In 2013, in partnership with Albany Medical Center, Saratoga Hospital opened Malta Med Emergent Care, a 24/7 facility located off the Northway at Exit 12. Other 2013 accomplishments include the establishment of Saratoga Regional Medical Group, a Saratoga Hospital-owned multi-specialty practice, and the opening of Saratoga Community Health Center, which provides primary care, dental, and behavioral health services to the underserved. The hospital's next major project is a $34 million renovation and expansion, including a new, larger intensive care unit, 10 state-of-the-art surgical suites, and separate areas for pre- and post-operative patients. Work is expected to end by the end of the year. Before joining Saratoga Hospital, Calboni was president and CEO of Mount St. Mary's Hospital and Health Center in Lewiston, Niagara Falls, New York, and CEO of the Health System of Niagara. He has a Bachelor of Science from West Liberty State College in West Virginia and a Master's in Health Services Administration from the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Calboni served on the boards of Saratoga County Chamber of Commerce, Saratoga County Economic Development Corp., and Shelters of Saratoga. He's also past chair and executive team member of the North County Heart Walk. Angelo Calboni, thank you so much for being with us. I've always admired Saratoga Hospital. It's a great-looking place. How did you get the job? Obviously, you have to go through a vetting process. What was that like?
First, I was fortunate to get the job. The institution hired a recruiter and was reaching out across the country for all practical purposes and made contact with me and began to describe the wonderful community that Saratoga Springs and surrounding area is.
Which it certainly is.
Great, great community to live in, and describe the institution and some of the things that made it strong and some of the visions for the future. And I thought, sounds like a place I'd love to take a closer look at. So that's how it happened.
So what was your childhood like?
What was my childhood like?
Yeah, you play baseball. I mean, what?
No, I was...
Were you bookish?
I was a little mix of both. I'm from, clearly with my name, Italian background, first generation American, and grew up surrounded by people who spoke broken English, worked hard.
Where did you live?
Wheeling, West Virginia.
No kidding.
Yeah, great. Right outside of Pittsburgh.
Here. Great country music.
Yeah, not a country music fan.
Yeah, well.
I loved listening to and playing rock and roll when I was young and making cars go fast. And so that's how I spent most of my youth.
I think, not to divert from our task here, but I think WWVA from Wheeling, West Virginia, you can hear on 96th Street in New York City, which is where I listen to it. So when somebody says Wheeling.
That's what you identify with.
Yeah, that and one more thing, and that is, you know, the big vats that people do laundry in were made out of sort of corrugated steel.
And they were.
And
they're
Wheeling.
It had been, at the time, Wheeling Steel, and that's Wheeling Pittsburgh Steel, and I think it's still called that.
Well, as you know, you can take those, put a hole in the middle, and put a pole next to it and make a wash tub base out of them. And that was my specialty, playing the wash tub base in Washington Square. And I owe that all to Wheeling, West Virginia. I wanted you to know. So where did you go to college again?
West Liberty State College is a state school near Wheeling, about 30 minutes away.
What'd you major in?
Business administration.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And are you a fan of state universities?
Yes, actually, all three of my children have gone through the SUNY system to some extent. My oldest switched schools in his last 2 years because he had picked a major that he needed to move off into a different program. My daughter's finishing Plattsburgh this year.
Which this radio station certainly gets to big time.
Good.
And do you have a philosophy of medicine? Do you have a philosophy of the delivery of healthcare?
I don't think you can function well in this business unless you have a philosophy and in a sense of a base of values about what we do. What we do is very personal and very important. And I, as I think most of my colleagues, see ourselves as stewards of a wonderful community asset. You know, we don't own it. It's not ours. We're there for a while to assure that we provide care to our community, our entire community, all the different demographics and important healthcare needs that exist. So my philosophy of healthcare kind of depends on what perspective you look at. I look at it from the institutional side, obviously, through provision of hospital services and physician services. So, you know, our mission really is to serve our community and identify their needs and meet needs, staying financially viable and provide stability for our workforce. That's kind of a little bit of a narrow focus.
Well, you can't preach to the choir unless there's a church. I mean, obviously, your first obligation is keeping it viable, right?
Correct. Within the environment where we function at this time, which is changing.
You served at a hospital where, you know, which had a religious affiliation.
Mm-hmm.
Did that affect you?
I worked in Catholic healthcare for about 15 years. That was a wonderful experience. Worked for two different orders. It was a good place for me to grow up and learn the business and have very supportive, wonderful people to work with. Did it change how we did things? Not really. You know, at its core, healthcare is a very personal, supportive service, and I found that was very consistent within faith-based organizations. So it was very comfortable. You know, much what we do in healthcare translates across all the institutions, because if that didn't exist, we really wouldn't be very good at what we did.
So Angelo, I mean, I don't want to raise too sensitive a subject, but obviously there's some things that Catholic hospitals don't want to do, for
Correct.
Example, abortions and some other things.
Correct.
Has that transferred with you from the Catholic medical institutions to Saratoga Hospital?
No. Saratoga Hospital is a community organization. I had to serve the needs of the community, and I'm there to see that those services are provided, needs are met through our medical staff and our staff. Many community institutions choose to provide services or not services based upon what they think works in their institution. But I understand in my role that we are not a religious organization, and you know our services that we provide are driven through the philosophy of the medical staff and the board.
So what ticks you off about hospitals in general?
What ticks me off?
Yeah.
That's a hard question.
Well, I mean, what is it that you say, that's never going to happen here?
That's never going to happen here. Let me maybe just kind of go to where I think Saratoga Hospital's success has been driven from. We have amazing staff that treats the patients, the families, and each other very well. Very supportive, empathetic. It's a friendly institution. And I would say most people that cross our threshold experience that. It's a very special culture that's been created and nurtured there. I think, frankly, it's driven a great deal of our success.
Is that because of the town itself? I mean, Saratoga is a wonderful town.
I think our culture is, in ways, a reflection of our community.
Yeah.
It's a very optimistic community, and our institution has been able to bring that into our organization. So, you know, what's not going to happen there? You know, one of my prayers is, you know, don't let me screw this up. It works well. We have great staff, and that culture has managed to get passed from our existing staff to new incoming staff. They see it. They learn from it. They embrace it. So that's what I wouldn't want to happen in our organization. We want to maintain that and nurture that and keep it.
When I read your introduction, which is impressive, I was struck by the fact that there were so many references to your commitment to people who didn't have means. Is that something that is special to you, to Saratoga, or is that a national issue right now?
Well, I think it's important to me. It's important to our organization. It should be important to all not-for-profit healthcare. We're allowed to function as a not-for-profit, tax-exempt organization, and with that comes a responsibility that the community lets us function in that manner. Every dollar of profit we make has to be used as a reinvestment back into the community. So our obligation is to provide care across the community, to all the different demographics, income levels. So it is something that we see as important and we take very personally.
I guess you know I was going to ask this question, I'm sure, but obviously we're in the middle of a great firestorm over Obamacare or Affordable Health Care Act. How does that affect something, an institution such as yours?
Over time, it will create profound changes in how healthcare is delivered, but that's not all bad. I think many of these forces were coming anyway. As a country, we use too much healthcare. We probably consume too much institutional healthcare. I think most people would agree with that. Just the way our system has been built, consumption has been a natural outcome. We have a lot of capacity. Coverages have existed to cause that. People have been shielded from the cost of care to a great extent. So the changes that are coming through healthcare reform, how we're going to get paid, how we're rewarded and penalized, is going to move the emphasis away from institutional care to less expensive care.
For example?
Primary care, care in the office, is probably the best single example. Managing care in the community
So is your emergency room overused?
Everyone's emergency room is overused.
And the alternative to that is what we spoke of when we introduced you, which is that in Malta you're setting up a 24-hour. So that will be less expensive for the community than going into an emergency room?
Yes. The insurers pay a lesser rate for services at a center like that. But the real key of managing healthcare to a lower cost isn't just bringing them through a different building. It's really having services in the community, having individuals follow a patient's health through a progression, having services that can help them maintain their health.
Is that pie in the sky or is that
no,
really
it's happening.
Happen?
It's happening right now.
So give me an example. I mean, tell me how that works. Right now, it's sort of hit or miss. Some of us have really great doctors. Others, you know, don't see a doctor for 3 years at a time. How do you change that experience?
Well, let me give you a fairly specific example. In our past, if you were admitted to the hospital for a particular disease, so congestive heart failure is a good example, and then readmitted 2 weeks later, and then readmitted 2 weeks later, and readmitted 2 weeks later. We get paid for every one of those admissions. We provide services, we're consuming resources. It sounds reasonable. We should get paid for each one of those. We're now moving to a world where we're not going to be paid and or we will be penalized financially if you come back in for that same disease or reoccurrence within so many days.
Why should you be held responsible for that?
Because someone had to figure out how to manage the system a little better.
Wait a second. Some guy's got congenital heart disease, and one night his wife takes him to the emergency room, or vice versa, and then 2 weeks later, he clutches his chest again. Why should you be? I mean, obviously, you got to bring him to the hospital.
Right, but what these changes are doing are forcing community institutions all around the country to put in place processes, systems, have staff in place to follow up with you, to make calls, to potentially have people go to your home to check on key indicators to see how you're doing. If you're not doing well, bring you into a congestive heart disease clinic to be evaluated and try to keep you healthy and in the community as opposed to crashing every 2 to 3 weeks and ending back in the hospital. In the end, is it better health care?
Well, it sounds great. Is it pie in the sky?
No, it's happening right now.
It is. So do you find your personnel tasks changing as a result of that? So, for example, we see now that there's a movement towards in hospitals called hospitalists, you know, people who, when you come in, instead of having the attending physician looking in on you for 5 minutes, you have somebody who's following your case in the hospital. That sounds like something that's quite doable. But what you just mentioned is really revolutionary.
Yeah, and while it may sound revolutionary, it's happening all across the Capital District now. Most every hospital is trying to figure out how to do this.
Well, good luck, Charlie. I mean, the fact is, trying to figure out is different from doing it.
Yeah, and we're starting to do it. Testing, evaluating, putting in place. Talk about changing staff. We have different jobs. We have different roles in our institution now. Many more individuals and effort around case management, which is really understanding what you're in the hospital for, trying to link you to the best services post-discharge.
This is really fascinating. So give us an example. Charlie goes in to the hospital. Now, is there somebody who takes charge of their case as a physician or a nurse, or how does it work?
Both. We have internal nurse case managers that will watch your stay through your entire experience at the hospital as we see things that you may need and relationships and connections you need post-discharge, start working on them while you're in the hospital. Now, institutions have done this for quite a long time, but the level of importance is being elevated greatly.
Who pays for it?
We pay for it.
The hospital pays for it.
We pay for it because it is something that if we don't do well, we will lose payment or be penalized in our Medicare payment. So the interesting point inside of this, there's been a lot of criticism of healthcare reform because it's going to add coverage and
to 49 million people,
which is a good thing.
Yes, of course.
And then the criticism is, well, this idea of saving money in the healthcare system is ridiculous. That's never going to happen. It's happening right now every day.
Do you see that in your bottom line?
Every month, there is less and less utilization of diagnostic tests, of ER visits, of less readmissions to the institution.
Really?
Yes. It's happening in every institution right now. So the criticism, oh, there can never be money saved in the system to offset the investment, just isn't true. It's happening right now.
I'm fascinated, but I'm also from Missouri. Not really, but I really want to know more about how that works. So show me. Charlie comes in to the emergency room. clearly it is in your interest not to have Charlie coming into the emergency room because that's what the feds don't want, right? I mean, they want continuum of care.
It's a little bit of a conflicted priority for us now, because on many occasions we're still paid for those visits. But we know we're going to a place where we may not be paid or we could be penalized. And you can't wait till the system's completely in place to change. So we're changing now, sometimes in ways that may financially not be rewarding to the institution, but we know it's a direction we had to get to. Things that are causing that to happen, look in some of the health exchange policies of the co-insurance, co-deductible, co-pays that people need to consider now when they use healthcare services. In years past, and this is happening across most insurers now, and it's going to continue to accelerate. In years past, if you had a prescription to get, example, I knew if your knee hurts, a physician gives you a prescription for an MRI. A few years ago, you would have just gone and had the test. Now you may have an insurance policy that requires you to pay the first $1,000 or $2,000 out of your pocket.
Really? Even under Obamacare?
Yes. There are, depending on what kind of product you buy.
Right.
There's going to be cost up front. What do you think many people will now do? They'll wait a week or two to see if their knee doesn't hurt.
Oh, that's very interesting.
And not run and get the exam. If you now may face a personal out-of-pocket cost of $200, $300, $400, $500 to go to an emergency room, you're going to think twice before you go to the emergency room. You may say, I'm going to wait to see if I can get into my doctor's office in a day or two.
Now, let me stop you and remind everybody that we're talking to Angelo Calboni, the president of Saratoga Hospital and all its affiliates. But don't you create, by doing this, a bit of an economic divide between the rich and the poor? So somebody's got millions of dollars and the doctor writes a prescription and says, go have an MRI. And you say, sure. What's it to me? $5 tip for me. I'm not talking about Alan. I'm talking about for somebody who has millions, as opposed to somebody who's in that 49 million who just got put on the Medicaid or Medicare rolls. They can't afford to do that.
Yeah, you're right. There will be individuals that have the ability to just say, well, it's an irrelevant decision. I'm just going to go get it done. But you have to really have to take a global look at this and challenge what we've been doing for the last 50 years. We've been consuming healthcare at an ever-increasing rate. And when you really measure outcomes, has the consumption always driven better outcomes in healthcare? In some instances, it has. In many instances, it hasn't. And it gets back to what we talked about originally. Have we been consuming too much healthcare? The answer to that's probably yes.
Probably so, yes, taken as a group, as a whole, but probably not when it comes to Alan's healthcare. when I go to, I'm feeling a chest pain, boy. I'm going to the emergency room. I don't care if it costs $300.
Yeah, and frankly, chest pain is probably not a really good example.
No.
We're talking more about elective work in many instances.
What category is it within elective?
Non-emergency. Again, your knee hurts.
Okay.
And will you have an MRI where you see how it does? Will you have arthroscopic surgery on your knee, or will you see if maybe a little physical therapy can work the pain out? Those choices now are going to become much more in individuals' faces as they look at policies and coverages that expose them to more of that cost up front. So the consumption of healthcare is probably going to moderate and come down. I think you can already see that in the data right now.
Okay. Angelo Calboni, tell me this. When it comes to Medicare, what percentage of your budget is paid for by Medicare and Medicaid?
Medicare is about round numbers, let's say about 40%.
That's huge. Yeah.
It's a big piece. Medicaid is a little under 10%.
Right.
So about half of our operating budget is from state and federal funds, approximately.
Which of those two pays better in the parlance of doctors?
Generally speaking, Medicare pays a little better than Medicaid, but it's a close race.
We see, Angelo, if I can call you that, doctors are opting out of these programs because they're saying their reimbursements aren't enough. How does that affect you as the hospital administrator?
There are a number of physicians who for years have not participated in Medicaid, as an example.
Right.
Which is health care essentially for the poor.
Which is why I asked you the question about who paid better.
Yeah. I've met physicians who have said, I'll take individuals into my practice and take care of them. It's actually easier for me to care for a patient and not bill and do it as charity care than it is to go through the production of...
Interesting. Now, they say that, but do they really do it?
Many do.
And that's deductible for them from their practice, isn't it?
No, it's just...
They just do
income
it.
Income that was never earned.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So to answer my question, the doctor who doesn't take either Medicaid, which we know is more prevalent, or Medicare, which we're beginning to see now.
Beginning to see. Yeah. Still fairly rare, but yeah. Beginning to see.
Now, how does that reflect on the hospital? In other words, you're charging out for services in the hospital, but the doctor may not be participating in the program. Is there a conflict in those two ways of doing things?
If that were to become more prevalent, that would be very difficult to manage. Because
why?
Because if you had Medicare, you're most likely going to need to seek out a different physician.
Which leads to an interesting question for me to you, which is, obviously, you have to give privileges to doctors.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want everybody who wants to be an affiliate to be credentialized by the hospital to be credentialized? Or do you sometimes say, no, this won't be a good fit?
First off, we don't have to give privileges. That's why they're called privileges. The hospital grants membership to the medical staff and grants privileges. That's a physician and board-driven process. We have standards and expectations individuals need to meet. And if they meet those standards, they can get on the staff.
You ever say no?
Oh, yeah, we said no. It's not an arbitrary no.
But what would a reason for saying no be?
An excessive history of malpractice, someone who maybe has lost their license along the way for reasons that we're not comfortable with.
Is there ever a knock on your door from some infuriated guy? It would be a perfect detective story for Law and Order or something like that, you know, with a revolver in there. Does anybody ever get mad?
Yeah, people can get him, but it's not a common occurrence.
Uh-huh.
And someone may be able to get staff membership, but not all the privileges they want because they haven't shown proper experience or training in a particular procedure.
Well, what would the difference between membership and privileges be?
Well, you would be a member of the medical staff.
Yes.
In the Department of Surgery, you may ask for privileges to do robotic surgery. And we look at your training and experience and determine you don't have enough training or experience to get privileges to do those procedures. You could be a member of the medical staff and not privileged to do a specific procedure.
Well,
that's actually more common than simply not granting someone membership.
You know, Angelo, I live in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. We have the smallest hospital in the state, Fairview Hospital, which I love. I'd rather go there than, you know, to NYU. I remember one day I had a problem down in New York City, and I called my doc up, and he said, go over to NYU and wait in the emergency room. I said, not me. I got in the car and I went back to Great Barrington. You know, these are wonderful little hospitals, and there'll always be somebody to say, are you crazy? You know, you have to go to Boston or New York City or whatever. And do you face that? I mean, in terms of this beautiful hospital you have there, people are saying to you, does it make you crazy? And say, no, I'm going down to visit Dr. O'Leary at the Hospital for Special Surgery rather than getting it done here.
Yes. I think every community hospital lives with that. And every large hospital lives with it relative to the next large hospital. It really just, it's a reality that we face.
Well, what do you tell Mrs. Gottrocks when she comes to see you and says, oh, my dear doctor, I'm going to Boston because I understand they're better over there?
Well, it depends what they're looking for.
Yeah.
There are many instances where our physicians, our staff, our institution would say, yes, you're right. That's a service we don't offer. You have a need that goes beyond what we have capability for, and endorse and support and make a referral out.
But can you do brain surgery?
No, we don't do neurosurgery as an example.
Okay, so what's the difference between sending them to Boston, New York, or Albany?
It would be a patient and physician preference.
Mm-hmm.
So the individual's physician and the patient, the family, would decide based on what they think the needs are, where they could be best cared for. We don't, as an institution, really direct to that. But we know for much of the care that we provide, we're as good, if not better, than many of those large institutions.
Absolutely, in terms of the personal care.
Personal care, the skills of our staff, this is what we do. We do this quite often, and we've become very good at it. I would pick a community hospital over a large urban center for much of the care I would need. Not all of it. There are things that community hospitals cannot provide that you're going to want to seek out a larger, more sophisticated institution. We've been successful in recruiting and attracting very talented physicians at Saratoga Hospital.
How come? They want to live in Saratoga.
I think there's been several things that have helped us create momentum. A wonderful community to live in.
Absolutely.
As we have attracted very talented physicians, talented physicians like to work with talented physicians. So talent has brought talent to our institution and our community. So we have really created some nice momentum and have created, I believe, a very strong community hospital medical staff. So when I talk about the ability to stay in our community and get wonderful care for much of what you need, I mean it.
Sure.
We have physicians on our staff who are as good, if not better, than any I've met in my career. But there are things we don't do, nor will we ever do. We do not do open heart surgery at Saratoga Hospital. I don't think we ever will.
Is there competition between you guys and, let's say, St. Peter's and Albany and Albany Med? I mean, as much as you can tell me about this. In other words, is there a dissonance that you ever see that you would rather wasn't there?
Well, I think people in institutions, just by their nature, can be a fairly competitive bunch.
Tribal.
And there's a lot of pride and ego that go into what's been created. So, yeah, we clearly become competitive across institutions. And a lot of us driven by pride that what we've created is good.
Yes, but does that ever interfere with doing the best thing for the patient? And I'm not talking about only Saratoga Hospital, obviously. As you describe it, it's a generic problem and exists.
Doing the best thing for an individual patient?
Yes.
Rarely that I've ever seen.
Has it ever affected it?
Rarely that I've seen in my career for the individual patient. Have institutions duplicated investments that may not be in the broad scheme of things and are all of our collective best interests and how we use resources because of competition? Mm. Clearly that's happened. But when it comes down to the care of the individual patient, no, I don't see that.
Do you find that your planning process is sometimes affected by getting a particular doctor with a particular interest? In other words, I taught at SUNY for over 40 years. SUNY at Albany and SUNY at New Paltz. I was joint professor at both places. Each of them had a designation. One of the designations for New Paltz was, you're going to be the Asian African Center of the State University. I get there, Jerry Benjamin, who is the top guy in state government, gets there, and we say, hell with this. You know, we're going to do state government. We don't care what Albany's doing up there, even though they're the designee of this thing. And by George, we really built a great political science department. And so with that specialty, does that ever happen to you?
It happens in any organization as well as institutions. If a hospital has a physician that have the ability to recruit and that physician has a specific technique or skill or can attract a unique patient population, yeah, we may build a program.
And do you know that coming in, or does it sometimes just happen after the guy or the woman gets there?
We usually know it coming in. Mm-hmm. Usually know it coming in, particularly if it's a new recruit, we know it's coming in. As an example, we just recently intentionally recruited a very talented, very successful bariatric surgeon from the central part of New York State.
Stomach stapling and all like that.
Yes. Yeah. There's other procedures around weight loss surgery. He was recruited intentionally as we were designing a bariatric surgery program. So that was very intentional as to how that happened. When we recruited robotic surgeons, that was to support what we wanted to be a developing robotic surgery program.
But when you do that, as the head of the hospital, Angelo, do you then realize it's going to cost you money for equipment? I mean, you get a robotic surgeon, you're obviously going to get have to get the very expensive equipment.
Right. To the best of our ability, we try to plan for that in each annual budget. Uh-huh. We do a pretty good job. We don't do a perfect job because opportunities come up and you have to take
Well, and if the guy leaves or the physician leaves, mm-hmm. I don't want to be sexist about it, but if the physician leaves, you may have some equipment on your hands.
Right. And if we think it's a program that the community, in fact, needed and we were doing a good job,
we'll
start a recruitment for a replacement physician.
Well, I want to talk to you about infection rates at hospitals. Obviously, this is something that drives everybody nuts. And, you know, when you get the hospital reports on various hospitals and things, that they always tell you what the infection rates were. And I think the people who run these hospitals are very attentive to that issue. What has your experience been with all that?
I have a long-running experience with, I think, a seismic shift in our industry. When I was young in this business, much younger than now, healthcare was to a great extent based upon individual experience and an individual's belief that, you know, the experience they had was the best way to deliver care. Now, those kind of clustered into patterns. You know, everyone wasn't a cowboy here. We've moved from that to an environment where best practices, national standards, truly research-based protocol is replacing each institution trying to figure out how to solve its problems.
Can you give us some specific examples?
A good example was ventilator-acquired pneumonia was one of the early pieces of that.
What is that?
If you're on a ventilator for a period of time, you can get pneumonia.
Because the equipment isn't clean or
no, it has nothing to do with equipment. It just the fact of being dependent upon the ventilator. It's just not a natural environment. Institutions would watch that happen and attempt to deal with it and recover from it. Well, good research was done and understood that if you do a series of things and implement a series of protocols as to how you manage that patient, you can dramatically decrease the incidence of that bad outcome. That's happening across a whole lot of different cases.
Okay, because I'm a little slow. Mm-hmm. How does that happen? In other words, if they're on a ventilator, mm-hmm. now you improve that by
implementing certain, like how you raise or lower the head of the bed is like
interesting.
A simple example.
And that's you go by the research.
Based on research and objective outcomes.
Interesting.
That's been a big shift in our industry toward accepting that best-in-class research-based outcome. Now, healthcare has always, to a great extent, been driven by that, but I'm talking about those in-the-trenches, infection rates, how to manage complications. So healthcare has been adopting those very, very rapidly to become more systematized as how we provide care, which will improve outcomes. Back to the infection rates, that's happening within infection rates now. A big bright light has been shined on hospital-acquired infections that have been in existence forever and probably to some extent are getting worse because some of these resistant bugs that are appearing. So I would say most institutions are rapidly adopting new techniques, proven research-based techniques that are now beginning to drop those hospital-acquired infection rates. Consistent hand washing, hardwired policies, protocol, procedure around hand washing.
Well, we've known that since McKinley died by mistake.
Yeah, but it's to say each and every time, every individual who has contact with the patient, really hardwiring those kinds of things can dramatically drop infection rates, as simple as that sounds. Skin prep before surgery, the different ways of skin prep. Well, as opposed to just trial and error, there's great evidence now in the industry. If you do things in certain ways, you're going to dramatically drop the rate of infections. So those shared.
Have you ever had a doctor who refused to cooperate or a staff member?
No, I wouldn't say refused to cooperate. I would say we, along through my career, yes, we've had people who have been skeptics.
Yeah.
Because they have a career-long experience around how it's been done and it worked for them.
Sure.
So moving from what they know and it's worked for them to a new protocol that may work, yeah, we have had skeptics, but time has brought, frankly, most along.
We're talking to Angelo Calboni, who is the president of Saratoga Hospital in one of the communities I would most like to live in my life. If I wasn't living in Great Barrington, that's where I'd like to go. Town and gown, you got Skidmore up mm-hmm. there. Do you, as the president of the hospital, have to work with various institutions that provide a lot of the action in a particular community?
Well, I think I would say we have a pretty close working relationship across most of the other institutions in the area and in the region. My board chair is an executive with Skidmore as an example. So there's been good connectivity within Saratoga across many of the institutions. I think it's part of what's made our community very successful and special.
What about policing? I mean, you know, obviously people get shot, things happen like that, and the police bring somebody in and mm-hmm. they're under arrest. How's that work?
Our focus is the patient.
Right.
If the police need to be involved in the oversight.
Do you ever handcuff anybody to the bed?
Have we?
Now, do they?
If needed, we don't as care providers. You know, our focus is the patient. If the police are involved, they're in the space, they have to work around us. I must say, this is not a...
It's not a major thing.
This is not a major problem.
It's the kind of thing that fascinates me, and that's why, and that's why I ask about it. You know, one of the debates is between whether or not hospitals should have, let me give you an example. There are many, many medical practices now which are out of hospital. So in the old days, you're going to get a CAT scan, you're going to the hospital. Mm-hmm. Now there are practices, GI practices and others that have them in their own, their radiology practices. In some places like Pittsfield, there's been hell to pay because, you know, the president gets angry that this resource gets pulled out of the hospital and put somewhere else. He goes and he hires his staff, and the other guys are sort of out of luck in this particular case I'm thinking of. Have you had any experience like that?
Yeah, every hospital has had this experience to some extent or another. Physician practices have grown in size as hospitals and hospital systems have tried to grow in size to get a bit more critical mass. We're under a lot of pressure that we talked about, how we get paid, what we get paid, the regulatory restrictions that we're facing, the take-backs from the Medicare system. I could go on and on, but the pressure is
What's a take-back?
Coming in and challenging a case.
Oh, and they say you paid too much, or you charge too much.
Or shouldn't have been admitted to the hospital and all, and we're taking all that money back.
What do you mean you shouldn't be admitted to the hospital? How do you know that?
They review case and make a judgment that it should have been managed as a observation case or an outpatient and didn't meet the criteria for admission.
So when somebody comes into the hospital, to the emergency room, and says, I have chest pain, and the hospital, I'm making up an example, and says, the hospital says, well, you know, we're going to put you in for observation. Mm-hmm. They may come in and do a take back.
Yeah, they may. And if it's a case that's admitted to the hospital, technically, admission's actually a technical term, admitted to the hospital. Sure. Many of those cases are reviewed later, and frankly, in our opinion, sometimes in a very arbitrary way, the money's taken back.
So do you have to have a specialist who works for you to handle those guys, to handle the bureaucracy and knows exactly what to do?
Yeah, we have physicians and staff that review these charts. We make appeals. The regulatory burden is great.
So have we created, I'm asking Angelo if I can, have we developed new specialists? I know that the space agency has, quote, reentry expediters now. That's a new job. That was a new job. do you have similar types of people that you hire and specialists in order to just, for example, deal with the bureaucracy?
Yes. The answer is yes. We have internal staff that do this part-time and full-time, and there are consulting firms now that specialize in helping hospitals review these incidents and try to challenge the decisions.
Interesting. So if the feds come along and say, we wanted some of your money back because we don't think this person should have been there, you have the ability to go to an outside consultant, you know, maybe a law firm or somebody like that who can help you get the money back.
Appropriately appeal, and then we would see what would come of it.
Right.
So back to where we were going.
The
payment pressures, the regulatory burden, has caused groups to grow, and as physicians' practices have become larger and larger, they've been able to make sense of adding some of the diagnostic testing. You mentioned CAT scanning inside the practice because they have enough volume with these practices that grow to create critical mass to deal with some of these issues that we're talking about.
Yeah, these are the guys who do it. They have practices. They do it in their offices.
Yeah, they do it in their offices.
And they do surgery in their offices.
Some do. So that's grown, and historically that would have been activity that happened at a hospital.
Sure.
Historically.
So? So the answer is?
I'm not sure what the answer is, but it's added pressure to institutions. The constant whining you'll probably hear out of hospital execs is that we're responsible for being open 365 days a year.
Indeed.
24 hours a day, staffed with expertise, resources, equipment, and supplies for that issue that comes in at 3 a.m. That's very, very expensive. If all of the activity that can be profitable in the system is extracted from hospitals, hospitals cannot survive.
Which means?
Hospitals fail. When healthcare reform was first analyzed a few years back, there were projections that approaching 20% of hospitals may not survive this transition.
So what's happened? Those hospitals aren't absolutely always closed. They may combine with a bigger
institution. Some can be frankly, simply closed.
Yeah.
Combined with a bigger institution, reorganized to be something less than they were. But we're watching that happen all across the country
now. Okay. Okay.
Because there's less payment, less volume being driven by the changes. We have had some of this volume kind of drift away from hospitals into some of these practices we're talking about. And that's, frankly, just kind of a natural movement in our business. We have physicians that provide services such as this in their practice. I consider many of those physicians great partners to the hospital. They
sure.
provide great care and work with us
and
very well.
You don't have
well.
To do
it. It's just kind of a reality we're living with right now.
Well, on the stock market, we have hostile takeovers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't expect that you're going to give me a specific answer here, but I'm hoping have either Albany Med or St. Peter's come and say, Angelo, if we can, we'd really like to consider taking over your hospital.
Let me kind of peel apart your question. The question of taking over your hospital, no, that's not how these conversations go.
How do they go?
I think it's fair to say probably every institution across our region is asking themselves an important question. How do we fit in? What kind of alliances or linkages make sense? How do they strengthen our institution? How do they help us take care of patients? Which is really at the core of what we're here to do, take care of our community, provide great care to our community. Every institution in the region is asking that. If you were to go to another area of the state, another area of the country, my answer would be the same. Probably everyone is asking themselves that question. In the not-for-profit world, it doesn't translate into the hostile takeover scenarios as to who's taking over.
Well, but some of it, Angelo, if I can, is competitive. I mean, I sense, I may be wrong, but I sense that within our area here where we're speaking,
mm-hmm.
there is a competition between St. Peter's and Albany Med. And
clearly.
And that if you can, you know, get one more institution, a prestigious place like, and it is, like Saratoga Hospital. It's a great area, you know, the rest of it. Certainly, it would be a feather in some CEO's cap if they could haul you in their sphere of influence. Is that too simple?
Haul us in and
is that too simplistic?
I understand the question. Our focus in the institution and our community is how do we best take care of our community?
Right.
You've already seen us partner with an Albany Medical Center in Malta because we thought that was a great way to take the strengths of our two institutions, possibly not compete in the same small space, and do a better job. It's open. It's functioning. I think it's going to work very, very well. So relationships can take all different kinds of forms, and of course, we're thinking about that now. Is Saratoga Hospital something that other systems would like to have? I hope so.
Gotcha. Let me ask you this. One of our great staff members, Selma Kaplan, quite frequently says, as we get in here on a Monday morning, what fresh hell today? And there's always some kind of fresh hell. I mean, something, somebody is complaining or saying, you know, I didn't like that program. I don't like what you said, that kind of stuff. When Angelo goes into work on Monday morning, does he ever say what fresh hell?
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, right. And Friday.
So what are some examples of a fresh hell that you may have to face?
Well, it would be an insurance relationship with one of our insurers that maybe isn't going in the direction that we'd like it to.
Meaning, I'm sorry.
We have contracts with all of the insurers,
yeah.
CDPH, BMVP, yeah. Blue Cross Blue Shield. Those are relationships that always need
and
to be
And someday somebody says, I'm not paying.
Paying, challenge on a case. We open a new process that someone doesn't want to pay for. We have physicians relocate to other communities. We lose staff. Take your pick.
Is it hard for you personally? I mean, you got a board to report to. You've got, you know, these outside things. Do you ever say, as I do, why me?
As people would remind me, I asked for this job.
Sure.
So now this is, I don't think there's lots of other things in my life I could have had great illusions in about doing. But in reality, I really, really like working in healthcare.
Uh-huh. How do you relax?
I try to develop some hobbies.
Like what?
Enjoy cars.
Do you?
I enjoy working on them, owning them, driving them.
Uh-huh. You fix them. You know how to
mm-hmm.
do it.
Yeah, a little bit. Used to do a lot. Used to do a lot more than I do now.
So much admiration for anybody who can do that.
There was a point in my life when I thought I wanted to play music.
And what kind of guitar? Kind of music do you play? You play guitar.
Yeah. Until I woke up one day and realized I just wasn't really good enough.
It hasn't stopped me. Did you play in a band?
When I was young. Uh-huh. Yeah, just kidding. We didn't make it too far out of a garage on most days, but so I joke, I try to relax, but I'm just more comfortable being nervous, so.
How many hours a day do you work?
Varies, 8, 10, 12, depending on what's going on any day.
Uh-huh. How much do you depend on senior staff, the vice presidents, the people who work for you, when a crisis is approaching, when somebody won't pay or something like that? How much how important it is to have a confidant, to somebody that you can really depend on?
And this just isn't a throwaway comment. My staff, and when I say my staff, I mean nurses, physicians, housekeepers, cooks, and my vice presidents make me look good. Because when I go out into the community and people tell me how wonderful the care was and experienced it, they didn't experience me, they experienced my staff. My job would not be, I couldn't do my job if I didn't have those folks in place. Most of them like doing what they're doing and enjoy health care in much the same way I'm describing.
Okay, here's a killer question, one you could ask me, and I certainly have is the answer. Have you ever had to fire anybody?
Of course.
On the great scale, I'm not asking you individual cases, but on the great scale of things that you find difficult to do, where would you put firing somebody?
I don't enjoy it, obviously.
Sure, of course not.
It's always hard. Firing for cause, yeah. Serious cause.
Could be.
Is a necessary part of the job.
And but do they know it's for cause? Is there always a defensive rationale that, you know?
In my life, yes. No,
right.
Yes. Yeah, very, very clear.
If you can make the case.
Yeah, there's some very bright lines for me that if someone were to cross, they can't be a part of the institution. They can't be a part of my organization. Those are less hard than having to reduce staff or just shrink a department.
As things change, as needs change, obviously you have to do more of that, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have been fortunate, Saratoga. We have grown as an institution. Our revenue, which is total dollars that we would expect to collect for services, grown from about $70 million in 2000 to about $250 million this year.
It's huge.
We have about 2,200 staff.
Is it the largest employer in Saratoga?
I believe we're the largest private employer in the county.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I believe. Could have changed a little bit last time we really went out and looked, but I think we're the largest private employer. So, yeah, we have grown. So we have been very fortunate that, we've been in an additive. Now, we've clearly slowed. I mean, we're slowing.
As the economy, when it went south, did that affect you?
A little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, a little bit. It did. And again, it was around how people chose to access services that had out-of-pocket, that would be impacted by out-of-pocket expenses.
I only have a few minutes, but I want to ask you this. How do you manage your board?
I try to be very disclosing, very open, try to share my concerns, fears, hopes, dreams, sufficient so that when we need to make the hard decisions, they feel as though they saw it coming for quite some time and had time to process it. We try not to make big decisions in a singular meeting. I often say to people, you really like a board when they have to make a really hard decision to feel like they had already made it because they've talked about it enough, processed it enough, had plenty of time to ask questions. So try not to take them by surprise.
Our guest has been Angelo Calboni. We are out of time. Angelo, I can't tell you how interesting this has been to me. You know, when you sit down, you never know what's going to happen. But boy, you really gave me a terrific interview today, and I very much appreciate it. He's the CEO of Saratoga Hospital and its affiliates, and we are immensely grateful to your taking the time to come down here and see us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for doing a great job for our community.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.